This is Audible.
Blackstone Audio presents Total Cat Mojo, The Ultimate Guide to Life with Your Cat, by Jackson Galaxy, with Michael Delgado and Bobby Rock. This book is read by Sam Osheroff. This book is dedicated to Barry, teacher, empath, healer, comic genius, exception to the rules, first-time cat, full-time friend to all beings. Loved and missed beyond comprehension or expression. May your travels through time bring you back to us. Introduction. Chaos Mojo. I am in front of a large and very enthusiastic audience in Buenos Aires while on a tour of Latin America. Over the course of the year, I've adjusted to speaking with a translator in places like Malaysia and Indonesia, and I had just been in Bogota and Mexico City. If you can have simultaneous translation with the audience wearing headphones, it is a blessing beyond belief because the audience is with you. The laughing, gasping, and applauding happens, one hopes, just a second or three later than with an English-speaking crowd. In the big scheme of things, it's a minor inconvenience. But when you and your translator switch off, you finish a full thought before he begins, well, it's just a massive headache at best, an absolute kamikaze mission at worst. My translator would stand next to me, a ghost dodging my physical outburst and stream-of-consciousness rants. The more excited I get, however, the less I remember to heed the presence or the needs of my ghost. Some translators, the ones who pride themselves as practitioners of a linguistic art form, allow me to get an entire paragraph out of my mouth before tapping me on the shoulder or giving me that sideways glance in order to succinctly and with equal fervor catch the audience up. On this night in Buenos Aires, my translator isn't that person. She is actually a newscaster who happens to be bilingual. It is not the most graceful dance, that's for sure. There is much in the way of toe-stepping on both of our parts. Improvisation aside, I always introduce the concept of Cat Mojo early in the show. It's the linchpin of my entire presentational spiel. That introduction, on this night, is firing on all cylinders. I'm feeling it for sure, as I attempt to occupy the space between Cat Guy and Pentecostal Revivalist. I'm breathlessly demonstrating what a mojified cat looks like, shamelessly preening, modeling the tail and ear postures, the overall gait and confidence. This all culminates at that moment when I say, "And what do we call this? Man, we call this Cat Mojo. Your cat has mojo." I allow that statement to reverberate, and it reverberates for entirely too long, going from a dramatic-filled beat to an awkward silence. I give my translator that sideways glance. Nothing comes out of her mouth, and her eyes betray a slight panic. At once, she allows her newscasterly character to fall away. She leans in close to me and whispers, "Chaos Mojo!" And I respond, in hindsight, maybe a bit too loud. "What do you mean, what is mojo? You don't know what mojo means?" We're having a conversation on this stage, and with every passing reverberant second, I'm losing my grip on this audience. Incredulous, I turn to them with equal measures of validation-seeking and creeping dread, and say in full Sideshow Barker voice, "Hey, folks, you know what mojo means, right? You've got your mojo on. You've got your mojo working. How many people here know what the word mojo means?" Cue the crickets. That feeling of creeping dread is now a full-on, flop-sweat-inducing nightmare. For the first time since I was 12 years old, holding a guitar with a broken string at a YMCA talent show, I am about to flame out before a live audience, and I couldn't think of a single way out of it. I think back to 2002, when I was sitting at my desk in Boulder, Colorado. The desk consisted of a big chunk of particle board resting on two sawhorses. I was inspired at the time to turn what I knew into a manifesto of sorts. Well, less inspired and more motivated. After a few years as an independent behavior consultant, I found myself trying entirely too hard to boil my knowledge base about all cats down to a relatable info nugget for my clients so we could more readily get to the part where they apply that knowledge to getting to know their cats. As is the case today, but much more so back then, cats are dismissed as being inscrutable. So far outside the behavioral and experiential realm of humans that we have no anchor point to hang a relationship on. I was determined to find that hook. Finding the hook was not about convenience either. Remember, I had worked for 10 years in an animal shelter and was more than a little invested. Far too many cats, millions a year, were, and still are, being killed in these shelters. Time and time again, I would witness a question mark-shaped barrier of communication becoming a barbed wire fence that led to the fracturing of very tender and tenuous relationships. It was the mystery of cats' behavior, their inscrutable nature being fed through the human gumball machine called ego and emerging as a perceived insult, that compelled those frustrated humans to surrender them to the shelter or even turn them loose into the street. I was trying to, at the very least, take the barbed wire off the fence so that the human and the animal could meet there safely and begin the process of deepening, instead of destroying, their bond. One hook that I had already started employing with my students and clients was the concept of the raw cat. The idea that the cat in your lap is, in an evolutionary way, millimeters removed from his ancestors. More on this in Chapter 1. The raw cat represents the innate drives that have influenced cat behavior for the entire time cats have roamed the planet. The need to hunt, the realization that they are in the middle of the food chain, and the need to own and protect their territory. As such, I came to believe that many, if not most, of the problems that my cat clients were experiencing, with the exception of undiagnosed physical issues, could be boiled down to territorial anxiety. The raw cat, content most of the time to stay in a place in the back of your cat's mind, comes screaming to the fore when confronted with a threat to territorial security. Whether that threat is real or perceived matters little. The fact is, if they feel it, they will almost have to act upon it. It's not enough to address the symptoms that become hair-pulling annoyances to us. Rather, we must find the opposite of that anxiety and coax that raw cat quality out to the point where it dominates and eventually extinguishes the anxiety. Back to my makeshift desk. It was very late at night, and I was trying to push through that insistent hallucinogenic moment when sleep would come whether I liked it or not. The risk of going face first into the keyboard was 50-50 at best. I would type, realize that I was in zombie mode, go back over it, erase almost everything, and start again. I was about to pass out, so I got to my feet and started to concentrate on what confidence looks like instead of trying to explain it. Pacing my office, I decided that it was a strut. It was tail up in the backward question mark position, ears relaxed, eyes not dilated, whiskers neutral. No threat in sight. No fight-or-flight mechanism enacted. Neither the weaponry nor radar was needed. No need to take the feline alert system to DEFCON 1 and unlock the box that had the red button in it, because there was a deep, abiding sense that all was well in the world. This strut was not artificial in any way. It was not a product of how cats want the world to perceive them. In other words, it didn't come from a place of cockiness. It was confidence that could only come from a deep sense of knowing that they own their place in the world. They could go about their day without eyes in the back of their heads, without wondering whether what they owned would be ripped from underneath them. This instinct was so grounded that it was beyond skeletal. It was coming from the vibration of history, a quantum communication connecting cats to each other through the ages. The hook I was searching for, the thing I wanted humans to relate to, was what it felt like to experience the essence of confident ownership of territory. I thought that if guardians could recognize and massage this present state of confidence, as simplistic as it may seem, it could help them head off most of the symptoms they complain so bitterly about, including cases of aggression and inappropriate litter box behaviors. As I paced around the room trying to humanize this strut, this confident swagger, the first vocal manifestation of the physicality came out of my mouth. The gusto-filled refrain from one of my musical heroes, Muddy Waters. I got my mojo working. The hook had come and I was not about to let it slip away. I had to wake myself up. I splashed water on my face. I slapped myself on the back of my neck, something I think a friend of mine taught me in high school to keep me awake during class. I even stepped outside my apartment into the Colorado winter in the dead of night in nothing but my robe, partly to keep my mojo working, and partly just to be aware of the moment, because I was so sure that it would be one I'd want to remember. And I was right. As time has gone on, it's not an exaggeration to say that almost everything I have built in the name of helping cats revolves around humans understanding cat mojo. Now we're back in Buenos Aires, back to the moment of crickets and creeping dread. I'm on that stage asking the audience a simple question. How many people here know what the word mojo means? 2, maybe 3 people out of 500 raised their hands. I had built my career on a word that was falling on not just deaf ears, but on very confused ears. Because of the language barrier, and because I am completely panicking and without words, English or otherwise, I have no choice but to demonstrate. I am forced back to that night in Boulder, forced to find and deliver that hook again. I need to find something that, A, my audience can relate to, and B, my translator can translate. And all I can think of is Saturday Night Fever. And that scares me. I have no time to consider whether this would be a really bad evening sinking choice. So away I go, painting a picture, faithful to my teenage memories, of the opening frames of the movie. The Bee Gees Stayin' Alive is pounding. The camera captures the sidewalk of Brooklyn, tracing upward from the 70s fabulous-looking shoes. It starts to pan up from hem to belt of flared-out and equally fabulous pants, past the silky, open-to-the-chest shirt, finally rising to reveal John Travolta, a.k.a. Tony Manero. He is carrying a can of paint in one hand and a slice of pizza in the other. And we discover, from the shoes to perfect hair, the definition of swagger. Muddy Waters must surely be nodding his head in vigorous affirmation from somewhere in the great blues beyond. Tony has his mojo working. I pause a beat to gauge response. Between the increasingly frenetic tempo and tone of my interpreter and the steady outbreak of knowing smiles throughout the theater, I know the audience is getting it. So I begin to imitate the Manero strut. Tony knows things. In the spirit of mojo, he doesn't know these things as a way of convincing himself of his status. He just knows. The girls want to be with him, and the guys want to be him. Most important, Tony knows that Tony owns Brooklyn, or at least this couple of blocks of Brooklyn, and that is understood wordlessly, spoken through the mojified language of swagger. The Manero strut is not a walk of demonstration, of proving. It is simply the outer manifestation of a grounded inner sense of ownership and belonging. The pizza grease dripping off his chin, the cans of paint that signify his lack of status, even the unresponsiveness of the numerous women he is catcalling along the way, none of it matters. Doing the Manero strut back and forth across the expanse of stage has me winded. With my hands on my knees, I look up and am met with excited murmurs and head nodding, telling me that I just dodged a bullet for sure. Having my feet held to the fire by a language barrier is the best thing that could have happened. That night in Buenos Aires marks a maturation of the concept of cat mojo, not only because I can define it in a way that I never thought I had to, but because I now know that I can show anyone, regardless of cultural differences, what mojo is, and that their mojo comes from the exact same place as cat mojo. From my late-night epiphany in Boulder to the night in Buenos Aires 17 years later, to every live performance, every in-home consultation, every class I've taught, and every episode of My Cat from Hell, it all leads us here, to this book, Total Cat Mojo. My primary occupation through these years actually has not been about solving cat issues, but about teaching you how to find, cultivate, and hold on to mojo. Am I referring to you or your cat right now? Well, both, really. Because if you got your mojo working, it's a heck of a lot easier to bring it out of your cat. And if your cat has his mojo working, it's enough to make any human smile with envy. Even Tony Manero. Section 1. The History of the Mojified World. From Raw Cat to Your Cat. Cat Daddy Dictionary. Cat Mojo. For cats, mojo is all about confidence. Mojo is proactive rather than reactive. Cat's source of mojo is in question ownership of their territory and having an important job to do within that territory. That job is a biological imperative that cats inherited from their wildcat ancestors, and I call it hunt, catch, kill, eat, groom, sleep. When we create a rhythm that mirrors that of the raw cat, the ancestor, we're there. When cats are at home inside their bodies, they can make the space outside their bodies their home as well. 1. Who is the raw cat? There is another cat living inside your cat. Strip away the creature comforts, the cat beds, the mouse-shaped toys, a life spent looking out the window or lying peacefully on the couch. You might see a glimpse of that other cat when she wakes you up in the middle of the night hunting your toes under the blanket. And there you'll find that other, whom I call the raw cat. In essence, the raw cat is your cat's ancestral twin. These twins, separated by eons, are nonetheless in very close contact, as if there were a tin can and string telephone connecting them through their DNA strands. Through that straight and unadulterated line, the raw cat sends constant transmissions to your companion about the urgency of securing territory, hunting, killing, eating, and staying ever alert, because just as cats hunt, they are also being hunted. Everything about our cats, from their territorial identification and nutritional requirements to the way they play and behave, are linked back to their raw twin. These characteristics all represent a shared prime objective, passed down with minor dilution over tens of thousands of years. In fact, when you take into consideration how many traits, both physical and behavioral, that your cat has retained from the raw cat, it's safe to say that from an evolutionary standpoint, these twins are almost identical. Throughout this book, I'll be asking you to tune into your cat's rawness, because that's where Mojo lives. You'll start to recognize when she's tapping into her raw cat, and you'll learn the importance of knowing how and where that happens. But I also want you to have a true 360-degree perspective of her moment-to-moment actions, and that only reveals itself once we understand why the pulse of the raw cat beats so close to the surface. Raw cat roots. Once upon a time, a really long time ago, the first inkling of catness happened when carnivores appeared on the Earth. Carnivores evolved from smaller mammals around 42 million years ago. Members of this order, which includes cats, dogs, bears, raccoons, and many other species, are defined by the structure of their teeth, which are designed to shear meat, and not by their diet. Some members of the order Carnivora are omnivorous, or even vegetarians. The Carnivora, evolutionarily speaking, split into two groups, or suborders. The dog-like animals, called the Caniformia, and the cat-like animals, called the Feliformia. And what exactly helped define them as cat-like? Well, what would you call a group of ambush hunters who tended to be more carnivorous than other members of Carnivora? I'd call that the very rawest cat. Cat daddy fact. The genomes of tigers and domestic cats are over 96% similar, meaning the proteins that make the cat blueprint are organized similarly in many cat species. A beautiful mutation is born. How new species come about. As we're looking at our evolutionary cat timeline, you might be asking, what's with all of these splits and divergences? They mark periods when there was an ancestral species, the grandparent of all those cats, so to speak, and from that grandparent, a separate family branched off to do its own cat thing. Specifically, new species form when genetic changes occur over time and cause populations to mutate. These changes often happen when a group of animals becomes isolated from other members of the same species. This can be due to changes in the environment, perhaps an area becomes more or less protected, or prey abundance shifts, leading some animals to move to a different territory. There can be proximity barriers, such as when islands form or a new river emerges, creating separation between groups. And there can be behavioral factors. For example, when nocturnal animals are less likely to mate with animals who are active during the day. Cat Nerd Corner. Far East, Far Out, the origins of the Siamese cat. When cats spread to the Far East around 2,000 years ago, there were no local wildcats for these newcomers to interbreed with. This genetic isolation led to some mutations related to appearance, which led to several of the distinct features of the Oriental breeds, including the Siamese, Tonkinese, and Burmans. Recent DNA studies suggest about 700 years of independent breeding from other breeds, and while still the same species as other domestic cats, have a genetic profile that suggests they have a unique ancestor with origins in Southeast Asia. These genetic changes are usually physical, if the two species have different features, or reproductive, when two species cannot interbreed, in nature. But the lines can get a little blurry, as demonstrated by the ability of humans to produce several kinds of hybrid cats. Nonetheless, the faster the animals can reproduce, the quicker these changes can take effect, in evolutionary time, of course, and lead to new species. The small cats. Small cats can be further classified as either Old World, from Africa, Asia, or Europe, or New World, from Central and South America. Old World cats include domestic cats, wild cats, fishing cats, lynx, bobcat, caracal, serval, and cheetah. New World cats include ocelots, Geoffroy's cat, and puma. There is not as clear a division between the New and Old World cats as there is within other species of animals, mainly because all cats are evolutionarily pretty tightly knit. However, there are a few behavioral differences. For example, Old World cats lie with their paws tucked under the body, in the meatloaf position, while New World cats do not. Old World cats are less likely to pluck the feathers from their small bird prey, while New World cats are inclined to thoroughly pluck before eating their birds. Old World cats bury their poop, while New World cats do not. Imagine how different our litter box situation might have played out had our beloved house cats descended from New World rather than Old. Cat Daddy Fact. All big cats roar, except for snow leopards, but they don't typically purr, except for cheetahs. Small cats purr, but can't roar. This is due in part to a small bone in the neck called the hyoid. In big cats, this bone is flexible, but in small cats, it is rigid. The big cats also have flat, square vocal cords and a longer vocal tract that allows them to make a louder, lower sound with less effort. In small cats, the hardened hyoid combined with vocal folds are believed to create the purring sound. Roaring may give big cats another way to control their turf without fighting or engaging in face-to-face conflict. Its sheer volume is a long-distance message. I'm here. Keep your distance, please. For more on purring, see Chapter 4. With all of this talk about what separates Old and New World, big and small cats, and small from one another, we might forget the most remarkable, undeniably raw fact. All existing cat species, currently estimated at 41, share a common ancestor. And that means that all felines are obligate carnivores, with large eyes and ears, powerful jaws, and a body built to kill. All cats walk quietly on their toes, with protractable claws, which supports their silent stalk and rush hunting style. And, last but not least, perhaps the most unifying, and definitely the most mojorific, force connecting all felines, from lions to tabbies, is the drive to claim and own territory. The Road to Less Wild, the Domestication Story. It is difficult for scientists to form a really clear timeline of the recent domestication of cats, because genetically, physically, and behaviorally, they are so similar to their closest wild relatives. So much so that there's been a lot of interbreeding among domestic cats and other wild cat species. In fact, the word domestic, when applied to cats, has always struck me as fundamentally, well, just wrong. I don't believe that cats have ever fully been domesticated. This speaks to my insistence at seeing the rawness in your cat at all times. To me, in each moment that you identify the raw cat in your cat, you are disproving the very notion of domestication. That said, as we continue with our story here, let's take a look at what we do know about how the raw cat gradually transformed into what we now call the house cat. For thousands of years, cats lived with and around people, but were never completely dependent on them. F.S. libica, the ancestral species, appears to be one of the more tameable of all the closely related wildcats, suggesting a predisposition for living with humans. Ultimately, though, the pathway to evolution was laid by the benefits that cats and humans mutually provided for each other. As agriculture began to flourish in our earliest human settlements, the rodent population drastically increased. This made proximity to humans attractive to cats, and the natural pest control they provided attractive to humans. This would prove to be a recurring win-win theme throughout history. Gods and mummies. The downside of any long-term relationship between humans and animals is that it's not an equitable one. Humans, through the centuries, unfortunately always held the cards and could be very harsh in how they dealt those cards out. In general, cats seem to be revered in proportion to how much a cat's pest control prowess was needed. That said, the true human-cat roller coaster ride began in earnest as humans were left to simply appreciate cats for their unique personalities and brand of companionship. As the ride heated up, gaining momentum and speed through history, our feline friends often found themselves reviled to the extreme. We've all heard stories of cat worship in Egypt, but it's important to note that the Egyptian economy was highly dependent on grains, which means agriculture, which means rodents, which means, once again, cats playing their welcome role as nature's exterminator. This likely set the stage for the elevated status that would come to them in Egyptian society. Contrast this, for example, with the many parts of Europe where weasels were already playing this exterminator role, so cats were not of particular use. Still, the Egyptians revered cats, perhaps like no other culture. Cats were depicted throughout Egyptian artwork, lived in religious temples, and were kept as pets. The intentional harming of a cat brought serious penalties, and if a cat passed of natural causes, the human family would shave their eyebrows to mourn. This feline worship devotion is documented through the mummification of cats, who were often prepared for a life in the afterworld with mummified mice to accompany them. But even in the cat-loving environs of Egypt, the aforementioned roller coaster would take a few unfortunate plunges. Not all mummified cats were cherished pets. They were also used as offerings to deities, and the demand for these offerings led to cat breeding mills, so cats could be deliberately killed and mummified. The Prophet Muhammad was another cat lover, and in Islamic cultures, cats have always been appreciated for more than just their extermination skills. According to one of the most well-known stories about Muhammad's reverence for his beloved cats, when he was called to prayer and his favorite cat, Muazza, was sleeping on the sleeve of his prayer robe, Muhammad cut off the sleeve of the robe rather than disturb Muazza. Sound familiar? How many of you have forgotten getting off the couch because you had a cat asleep on your lap? In other parts of the world where cats were worshipped, particularly in pagan cultures, cats' hallowed status became tainted as the persecution of non-Christians increased. In fact, things got really bad for our cat friends during the Middle Ages, when they were associated with cults and declared unholy. It is believed that millions of cats were sentenced to death and burned in witch trials or thrown into bonfires. And if cat owners tried to protect their pets, they would face Inquisition themselves. The sad irony is that during this time, the Black Death spread and killed thousands of people. Rats, or rather the fleas they carried, were known carriers of the plague, and killing massive numbers of cats would have certainly contributed to the proliferation of rats. Granted, archaeologists have more recently called the relationship between rats and the spread of the plague into question, suggesting that the plague spread so quickly due to close contact between humans, not between rats and humans. Regardless, killing thousands of cats could not have helped matters. Even today, superstition and stigma continues to color folks' perceptions of cats. We've all heard, "Don't let a black cat cross your path," or that cats can steal a baby's breath. And even though cats are more popular than ever, we still kill them in mass numbers in shelters every year, and there has even been a widespread call to eradicate feral cats from the outdoors. Hopefully, these ideologies will soon become part of our past as well. From big to small. 11 million years ago. The family Felidae split into two categories of existing cat species, the Pantherinae, seven species of big cats, tigers, lions, jaguars, and four species of leopards, and the Felinae, which is mostly small cats, including the ones who live in our homes. For perspective, humans split from our closest relatives much later, between 5 and 7 million years ago. 9.4 million years ago, The first bay cats, Catopuma, form a separate lineage from the ancestors of all the remaining members of the Felini subfamily. 8.5 million years ago, the caracal lineage, Serval, caracals, Leptalerus, African golden cats, diverges. 8 million years ago, the ocelot lineage, ocelot, margay, pompus, leopardus, Geoffroy's cats, diverges. 7.2 million years ago, the lynx lineage, lynx and bobcat, lynx, diverges. 6.7 million years ago, the cheetah lineage, pumas and cheetahs, acininix, splits off from the remaining small cats. 6.2 million years ago, the genus Felis, the European wildcat, the Southern African wildcat, the Central Asian wildcat, Chinese desert cat, and Near Eastern wildcat, which includes our own domestic cats, form a separate lineage from other small cats, Asian leopard cats, fishing cats, and the Pallas's cat. 130,000 years ago, Near Eastern wildcats, our cats' closest relatives, split from other Felis. A 2009 genetic study of 979 cats, domestic, feral, and wild, demonstrated that all domestic cats are descendants of Felis sylvestris libica, the Near Eastern wildcat, and that the Near East was the origin of domestication. Domestication time. The timeline, like cats, is a little fuzzy. 12,000 years ago, the earliest human grain stores of the Middle Eastern Fertile Crescent created a high concentration of rodents, which would have attracted small carnivores. 9,500 years ago, archaeologists found evidence in Cyprus that a cat was buried with a human along with various decorations in a grave that was dated at almost 10,000 years old. Wildcats were not native to this island, meaning they would have been introduced by humans in some way. This individual cat may have been tamed, even if cats were not fully domesticated yet. 5,000 years ago, evidence of cat domestication in China, where the first domesticated species was the Asian leopard cat, Prionylurus bengalensis. This was a short-lived relationship. Perhaps because Asian leopard cats are notoriously more difficult to tame than F.S. libica, which frequently live in close proximity to humans. Today, all domesticated cats in China are descendants of Felis sylvestris libica. 4,000 years ago, evidence of domestication in Egypt. Remains of F.S. are found in tombs, and paintings and sculptures depict cats as existing side by side with humans and with collars. 2,500 years ago, despite a ban on exporting cats from Egypt, they moved to India, and by 2,500 years ago, cats had spread to Greece, the Far East, Eurasia, and Africa. 2,000 years ago, the Romans expanded their empire, and cats tagged along. 12,000 years ago, domestic cats spread into Northern Europe. 500 years ago, domestic cats spread into the Americas and Australia. Cats were probably passengers on the Mayflower to serve as pest control. Today, cats live on every continent except Antarctica. They are perhaps the most successful species on the planet in their ability to adapt, second only to humans. 2. The Victorian Tipping Point. Despite all of the ups and downs our raw cat has experienced through the centuries, nothing would impact her experience quite as much as her moving indoors. Come to think of it, the same could be said for our experience as well. This is where the evolutionary timeline starts zigging and zagging, and the human-cat relationship begins to define and redefine itself in rapid succession based on a new close-quarters living arrangement. But considering we were all doing just fine with the you-stay-outdoors-and-we'll-stay-indoors agreement that we'd always had with cats, how and why did this ever happen? And how have things progressed in the human-cat dynamics since? Moving on up. Around 150 years ago, humans decided to bring cats into their homes. Many credit Queen Victoria for popularizing the idea of, I like cats and I want them in my house. Queen Victoria was known as a bit of a loner, and also as a huge animal lover. She advanced the cause of animal welfare and, with her patronage, assigned the term Royal to the SPCA, making it the Royal SPCA. In addition to her many dogs, horses, goats, etc., she had two beloved Persian cats. Her last cat, White Heather, lived out her life at Buckingham Palace long after the Queen herself had died. During this time, Victorian-era 19th-century England, the practice of pet-keeping increased. The humane treatment of other animals was growing, and pets were both a status symbol and a way for the genteel to demonstrate their power over nature. The fastidiousness of cats may well have made them a perfect, wild but still clean species for humans to get close to. Also, many writers and artists expressed their love for the cat, and people began having funerals for their beloved felines. To a deluxe apartment in the sky. Clearly, much has changed since the rawest of raw cats roamed the earth, both from their relationship to humans and, to a lesser degree, their genetic makeup. While both cats and dogs have been famously successful at coexisting with humans, our relationship with cats, in stark contrast to dogs, has blossomed without us really asking them to change. The cat we had around to protect our grains from rodents is essentially the same cat we share a bed with today. The biggest shift in human-cat relations has occurred because of the demographic shift of cat ownership from a rural model to a more urban model. As previously mentioned, the role of cats in the rural model was more about being farmhand exterminators than about being part of the family unit, even to the extent that they might be let indoors. In contrast, the urban model has spawned a more affectionate, family member type of relationship between cat and guardian. There are a number of reasons for this. First, urbanism typically means that more people live singly rather than in groups and with fewer relatives nearby. Combine this with more divorce and fewer children, and you can begin to see how the human-cat relationship occupies a more central role in the guardian's life. Also, people in cities tend to live in smaller spaces and work longer hours. This has created a tendency to adopt smaller companion animals, like cats, as a matter of practicality. Oh yeah, and let's not forget my favorite reason for cats' popularity in urban settings. They are often portrayed as a low-maintenance pet. Of course, if that were the case, I wouldn't have a job, right? Still, this rural-to-urban, outdoor-to-indoor paradigm shift is not a done deal. Not even close. It is in progress. We are still very much shifting. For one thing, there are still many places around the world where cats are perceived as pests or vermin, and in cultures like ours, where they are loved and revered, many still see cats in the classic born-free model of their free-roaming ancestors and consider it cruel, an act of hostage-taking, to keep them indoors. As we've seen throughout the story of the raw cat and his human companions, the happily ever after is an elusive goal. Turbocharged evolution. How has living with humans changed cats? Approximately 96% of cats still choose their own mates these days. This is made for a relatively unaltered and organic genetic throughline in the majority of our modern cats. But that doesn't mean cats haven't changed simply by living with us. In a sense, cats have self-selected. Friendlier cats, who are more tolerant of humans, may be more likely to be fed and sheltered by them, and more likely to mate with cats who have similar friendly, tolerant genes. So, while there's been an absence of strong intentional selection for specific physical or behavioral characteristics among cats, it has actually been our relationship with them that has led to the most significant genetic changes. Cat Nerd Corner. What has changed with today's cat? In 2014, scientists collected cheek swabs for DNA analysis of 22 domestic cats of several breeds, Maine Coon, Norwegian Forest, Burman, Japanese Bobtail, Turkish Van, Egyptian Mao, and Abyssinian, as well as the Near Eastern and European wildcats. From this information, they were able to determine some of the key genetic changes that occurred in domesticated cats. Genetic changes that are associated with better ability to form memories, better ability to make associations between a stimulus and a reward, such as humans offering them food, less rapid fear conditioning, meaning today's cat is not as quick to go into fight-or-flight mode. Physical characteristics. smaller body, shorter jaw, smaller brain, smaller adrenals, which control fight-or-flight instinct, lengthened intestines for adaptation to scavenging human food. All cats have long canine teeth that allow them to kill with a bite to the neck. Domestic cats' teeth are more narrowly spaced than those of other cats because they are adapted to catching smaller rodents. Most domestic cats prefer prey. What has not changed with today's cat? Skull shape. The shape of the skull across all cat species is similar, and they have a specialized jaw designed to kill with a powerful bite. Our cat's skulls may be a lot smaller than lions and tigers, but the structure is very similar. Behavior, to a large extent. Most cats choose their own mates, which keeps the gene pool diverse. Cats still, for the most part, can survive without us. The puppet master enters. Purebred cats. Humans first got a decent grasp on the principles of genetics in the late 1800s when Gregor Mendel published his famous work on the inheritance of dominant and recessive traits in pea plants. Before that era, people were breeding animals, including farm animals and, of course, dogs. At that time, breeding of most animals was for the purpose of ensuring a reliable source of food. Dogs, on the other hand, were bred for specific jobs, to aid with hunting by flushing out game, to retrieve, or to fight. But when it came to creating desired results for appearance or behaviors, success was anything but consistent, primarily because we had only a rudimentary understanding of how genetics worked. But once we had that understanding, humans were able to influence cat evolution via controlled breeding, that is, selecting cats' mates for them. However, the starting point for breeding cats was for aesthetic rather than functional purposes. We weren't asking them to change who they were, just how they looked. As a result, by selecting and mating cats for certain physical features, the early breeds, such as the Persian, were born. In fact, the earliest cat breeding was often an attempt to achieve certain coat colors, with a misunderstanding that breeding a black cat with a white cat would produce gray kittens. The first championship cat show in the United Kingdom in 1871 featured Persians, Russian Blues, Siamese, Angoras, and Abyssinians, in addition to Manxes and short-haired cats of many colors. And once there were particular breeds of cats, up sprang several clubs to celebrate these breeds, and the cat fancy was born. Shows, judges, beaux, and proud parents, like toddlers and tiaras. But instead of focusing on the perfect spray tan and tap dancing routines, the fanciers developed standards that would define the preferred physical characteristics that a given breed should have, such as the shape of their eyes, ears, face, tail, and even their paws. Often, though, these differences were as simple as a coat color. For example, Persians were initially defined by their long chinchilla-colored coat, not by having a flat face. Seal point coloration alone was what distinguished the Siamese from your average cat. These breeds were distinct, but not extremely different in appearance from other domestic cats. Today, breeding is an altogether different beast, so to speak, with organizations recognizing anywhere from 44 to nearly 60 different breeds of cats. In the process, we have pushed cats' physical appearance to extremes, often without regard for the well-being of the cats being bred. We've made the Persian's face flatter and the Siamese face thinner and more pointed. Consequently, the changes we have imposed through breeding are in many ways detrimental to the raw cat. By selecting Persians for the brachycephalic, short-nosed appearance, we have actually made it harder for them to breathe, increased the chance of skin, dental, and eye disease, and made giving birth riskier and more difficult. Scottish folds are used as a model for studying pain and arthritis because the mutations that cause the folds in their ears also lead to painful degeneration in their bones and cartilage. Manx cats are prone to back pain, constipation, and other elimination problems because of spinal cord deformities. Maine Coon cats are prone to heart disease, and Siamese cats have a higher likelihood of asthma and hyperesthesia. These are just a few examples. When you limit the gene pool, you increase the chance of dangerous mutations and disease. There's no other way around it. Humans may be pulling the strings when it comes to cats' exteriors, but are we making any progress in understanding their inner world? For all the progress we've made by bringing cats indoors, cat domestication has ushered in a new set of problems, at least from where I stand. It seems that no matter where the pendulum swings, it doesn't swing in full favor of the cat. Previously, their role as farmhands secured their survival, but, as we've seen, not their status. Likewise, they are now too often seen as family light, more of a representation of what it is to parent another than actually occupying the true nature of that relationship. Now, I'm not trying to hang humans out to dry. This period of massive adjustment cuts both ways, and it's asking a lot of both parties to change the way they live in order to accommodate another. I'm just asking you to think about this. In the less than 150 years since Queen Victoria, which is an evolutionary blink of an eye, we now ask cats to pee in a box, sleep all night, sit on the couch, not traipse across our counters or computer keyboards, and last but not least, to shrink their territory from a few hundred acres to a studio apartment. The upshot here is that the more that cats are seen as home accessories, the less they can achieve the ideal we've set for them, and the more slippery the slope that leads them back to social pariahs. And there you have it. 42 million years of evolution and a thorough introduction to the raw cat all boiled down to a couple of short chapters. In section 2, we'll get into everything you always wanted to know about your cat, as he or she exists in the present, but were afraid to ask. Bringing the outdoors in. Here's a quick overview of the modern cat's rising rank in society, once the indoor cat model was popularized. 1871, first cat show in the United Kingdom. 1876, first manufacturer of cat food in the UK, Sprat. 1895, Sprat brings cat food to the United States. 1895, first cat show in the United States. 1930s, U.S. production of canned cat food. 1930s, spaying and neutering of cats and dogs introduced. 1940s, meat shortage. Limited meat rations in the 1940s leads to the development of dry food, which made use of livestock scraps and fish. Dry food eventually becomes the majority of cat food produced and purchased. 1947, invention of kitty litter by Ed Lowe. Before that, people used ashes, dirt, or sand, but most people let their cats go outside. 1940s and 1950s. Spay-neuter continues, but is not common. General anesthesia is recommended, but not required. Somehow the idea spreads that it is humanitarian to allow females to have one litter. 1950s. Explosion of cat food brands. 1969. First low-cost spay-neuter clinic opens in Los Angeles. Before that, euthanasia numbers were off the charts. 1972. ASPCA requires adopted animals to be spayed and neutered before going home. 1970s. Change to primarily indoor-only lifestyle, especially in the United States. Recommended by many veterinarian humane organizations to protect cats from danger, to protect wildlife from their hunting, and because cats are increasingly accepted as family members. 1990, TNR, Trap, Neuter, Return, emerges. 1994, first mobile spay-neuter truck is started in Houston, Texas, when it is recognized that people need the service but cannot always travel to a vet clinic to get their pets spayed or neutered. 1999, the Organization in Defense of Animals, IDA, begins the Guardian campaign, seeking a change of language and legal status for companion animals by changing the term pet owner to pet guardian. 2003, West Hollywood becomes the first U.S. city to ban declawing. Section 2, A Crash Course in Cats. 3. The Raw Cat Rhythm. Back in the early days of my job, I just assumed my clients and students, along with cat guardians everywhere, were thirsty for knowledge about all cats, so I spent entirely too much time staying up at night trying to break my philosophy down into bite-sized pieces for them. It turned out that most of the cat people in my stratosphere were mainly interested in knowledge relating to their cats, because, understandably, those who hired me wanted to know how to make their cats stop acting out. As a result, they saw my impassioned attempts at connecting the cat dots as unnecessary icing on the cake. This led me to the revelation that, when it came to getting these folks on board the big picture train, I had a very small window of opportunity before their eyes started glazing over. And so, just as I did with the term cat mojo, I needed to find that hook, a quick-fire way of reminding guardians that their cat's behavior was tied to the behaviors of the raw cat. In this case, I wanted them to understand the paramount importance of the three R's, routines, rituals, and rhythm, in their cat's life. The three R's are based on the hunter's lifestyle of their ancestors. The raw cat, as we've established, needed to accomplish very specific tasks every single day in order to feel mojified. The hook that I came up with, that mnemonic sticky note, was hunt, catch, kill, eat, groom, sleep. HCKEGS. I would, and still do, have my clients repeat the words in rhythm and with gusto, as if we were cat cheerleaders, until it became a mantra. The mantra, once absorbed, serves as a constant reminder to the guardian that this raw cat rhythm makes the world go round for your cat, and it is your job to feed the rhythm. This reminds you to establish routines around playtime, rest time, and mealtime, even down to what your cat is eating. Every road leads to Mojo, and one of the major street signs along the route says, in neon letters, HCKEGS. Hunt, catch, kill, eat. Historically, as we discussed in Section 1, our goal for cats to serve as nature's pest control and their goal for themselves as honorary exterminators aligned perfectly. Hunt, catch, kill, eat, HCKE, the anchoring foundation of raw cat rhythm, and the four-step process that cats engage in to procure and devour their food, served both parties well, and that's why our relationship with cats followed the same trajectory for so many years. It's really been in just the last 150 years that this thread has frayed, and a fork has appeared in the road to cat domesticity. Until then, it was a given that cats should be outside and that it was cruel to move them indoors. That's what makes this moment in time so important for our future. What was a given for thousands of years suddenly is not anymore, as we continue to reconcile the safer, better quality of a life of indoor living with a cat's innate biological drives. HCKE is not about providing a minimum of care for your cat. It's a reminder of the direct thread that connects your cat to her raw cat ancestor. It's that tin can on both ends of a string communication I keep talking about. Still, so many people want to know, is it okay if I don't play with my cat? Or, can I get an automatic feeder and leave my cat alone for 2 days? Instead of wagging my finger and saying no, the goal is to show you, from the crucial starting point of HCKE, how obvious the answer is, to the point where you won't need to ask those types of questions. And if HCKE is our diving board, and cat mojo is the water we dive into, then understanding a cat's key physiological mechanics, particularly as they relate to hunting, well, that's the spring in the board. How the cat experiences the world as a hunter. As natural-born hunters, cats rely on multiple senses to do their thing. Primarily touch, vision, and hearing. This means that virtually every part of your cat's physiology has a function in the hunting process. Touch. Cats are extremely sensitive to touch. This is in part because they have skin receptors that fire continuously as long as they are being touched, meaning these cells don't adapt to physical contact because the brain keeps getting a signal saying, "I am being touched." This is in contrast to humans, whose sensory receptors, for example, do adapt to touch, as evidenced by the fact that we don't consciously notice, moment by moment, that we are wearing clothes. The type of cells that cats have, Merkel cells, are ultra-sensitive, more like those on your fingertips. Even their hair follicles are innervated, so having hairs out of place can be irritating for a cat. Here are a few more interesting tidbits about cats and touch. Cats have some areas that are extra sensitive. The nose, toes, and the pads of their front feet all have even more receptors than other parts of their bodies. Dr. John Bradshaw describes cats' feet as sense organs. Their nose pads can detect wind direction and temperature. Cats have hair receptors in their toes, which explains why long-haired cats in particular may be especially sensitive to things like the feel of litter on their paws and being groomed. They have short, stiff hairs around the mouth and wrist to detect vibration. The base of the claws can sense displacement, which comes in handy, for example, when a mouse is wiggling in the cat's grasp. Overstimulation and possibly even some self-grooming and compulsive disorders are often related to this exquisite sensitivity. So the next time you're petting or brushing your cat and he whips around to take a chunk out of your hand or brush, try not to take it personally. More on this in Section 3. At the same time, understand that all of this sensory perception is not just intended to accommodate their hunting activities. Cats are also prey for some animals, like coyotes and hawks. Being sensitive to touch means being sensitive to pain. Cats need to know if they are being attacked, to be extra cognizant of the warning signs of an attack, so their razor-sharp fight-or-flight mechanism can kick in. Bio-whisker. When it comes to touch, however, nothing comes close to the acute sensitivity of the whiskers. Compared to dogs, cats have a larger area of the brain dedicated to receiving signals from the muzzle area. Whiskers have receptors that communicate with the somatosensory cortex of their brain, giving them information about the ambient temperature, their balance, and the size of a space they are trying to move through. Whiskers can also detect movement and airflow and send messages to the brain about how strong, what direction, and how quickly the air around them is moving, which could foretell potential movements of their kill. Cats' up-close vision is not especially sharp, so they rely heavily on information from their whiskers when prey is in or near their mouth. When in hunting mode, the 12 whiskers on both sides of the nose are held forward to detect prey's movement so that the cat can make fine-tuned adjustments for the killing bite. These whiskers on their upper lip, combined with the whiskers on their cheeks, over their eyes, and on the chin, inner wrist, and back of the legs, all help cats see in 3D. Cat daddy fact. Wildcat species who are nighttime hunters have more prominent whiskers than daytime killers. Vision. Everything about the anatomy and function of cats' eyes, and for that matter, every raw cat muscle, body part, and instinct, supports their existence as hunters. Cats have large eyes, in proportion to both body and head size, that face forward, which is common in predatory animals. Their visual field covers about 200 degrees, including their peripheral vision. Of that field, 90 degrees is binocular, in which both eyes work together for depth perception, such as determining how far away a bird is. Cats' eyes are also more responsive to fast movement, ideal for allowing our beloved hunters to catch a scurrying mouse. However, their vision is not used so much for the up-close handling of prey, as their short-range vision is rather fuzzy and less detailed than ours. Instead, their optimal focal distance is between 2 and 6 meters, perfect for stalking a bird or mouse. If the prey is closer than a foot away, the cat's eyes don't even focus. At that point, the whiskers take over by pointing forward to pick up the details. That said, indoor cats are slightly nearsighted because the objects they focus on tend to be closer, while cats who go outside are usually farsighted, just like their raw cat ancestors. The eyes have it. Comparing cat's eyes to human's eyes. A cat's eye works in a way very similar to ours. Light enters the pupil, or the opening in the center of the iris, the colored part of the eye, is focused by the lens and cornea, then is projected onto the retina at the back of the eye. The retina has two types of receptors, rods and cones. Rods are specialized for low-light conditions, and the cones are best for daylight color detection. Here's where a major difference between cat eyes and human eyes occurs. Cats have 3 times the number of rods as the human eye, but they have fewer cones than we do. So although they can detect some color in daylight, colors aren't nearly as prominent or apparently important to them. In dim light, they can only see in black and white, but they can see much more clearly than we can. As always, everything boils down to whatever helps the hunt. They will take clarity over color any day of the week. Speaking of how evolution has helped the raw hunter, here are a few more key differences.